Thank you, Michael. I always get very nervous when somebody who knows me as well as Mike Bryan does introduces me, because he could have gone in so many different directions, and I appreciate you keeping it, on the up and up. I was worried, though, when I came in this morning and I saw him reading my bio. He's known me for 23 years. What were you going to learn from my bio? But thanks, Mike. Thank you, Tom. Thank you, BBI, for the invitation to be here today. You know, I've been to a lot of these events. I love coming to the Fuel Ethanol Workshop because, as I think I've said before, you know, you're the people that make the magic happen. You're in the plants producing the fuel. You're supplying our industry. You are among the 400,000 workers that our industry supports. And so I get so much from this event. I get so much energy from you every year. I love doing it. This is a different kind of year, however. These are unsettling times, for sure. The public discourse about ethanol is not what we would like it to be. The media coverage is downright uninformed and ugly. The political debates in Washington are fairly hostile these days. And it's pretty clear that policy is going to change. Add to that the fact that there's breaking news with respect to the E15 rule. There are negotiations going on even as we speak with respect to the tax incentive. And I decided to forego a speech. I'm not sure that that's what we need right now. I think it might be better to engage you in more of a conversation about what's going on these days and invite your questions to make sure that I'm responding to whatever angst there might be in the industry today, and we can sort of just address it. So I've asked BBI if that would be okay, and maybe they'd just bring up a stool or something. I'm going to forget the text, and I invite your questions. Let's just pretend we're at a bar down the street. There's one called the Rock Bottom. I was there a couple nights ago. Seemed appropriate. But that just means we got nothing but up, right? So it's all good. So think about some questions. I think first I'd maybe just talk to you a little bit about some of the breaking news. You probably have seen that yesterday the EPA finally released its E15 rule, allowing E15 to be used in vehicles 2001 and newer. It's not what we would want. We would want the agency to have allowed the use of this fuel for all vehicles. Certainly the data that we had provided to the agency, that the firm Ricardo had done, suggests that if you're going to allow E15 for a 2001 vehicle, there is no technical, no materials compatibility, no regulatory reason not to allow it for all fuels, but nonetheless, that's where we are. In that rule, EPA had issued its label. And I think the E15 label that they put out there was not as bad as we would have thought it could have been. Here's the label. I mean, it says attention, not warning, not caution, not danger, attention. Okay. I think that's not necessarily a bad thing. Let's let consumers know. We want consumers to be aware that there's E15 in this fuel. And it says don't use in other vehicles, boats or gasoline-powered equipment. It may cause. The proposed rule said it will cause. So EPA, I think, listened to our comments and has put out a label that the industry likely can live with. The challenge now would be to make sure that E15 is indeed a commercially viable fuel. And to that end, we still have a lot of work to do. We've been working with Growth Energy and others on the health effects testing. That testing is going quite well. We anticipate that we will be able to provide EPA with a final report, and producers will begin to register that fuel this summer. Registration will trigger commercial use, but there are still going to be some additional challenges. There are state regulatory challenges that we are working on. There will be issues with respect to fuel volatility that still need to be addressed, either in regulation or in the marketplace. We've got to figure out what the octane of E15 is going to be and how marketers will appropriately be able to label that fuel. Bottom line is, we're going to have to continue to work to take advantage of the opportunity that EPA is given. But we believe strongly that there will be E15 being sold commercially as yet this year. And we look forward to working with all of you, working with our marketers, working with refiners to make that a reality. If the industry is going to grow, we need to open up new markets, and E15 will be one of those. Now, just quickly as well, I want to touch upon the negotiations that are going on today. Look, you all know that while we were the cat's meow in 2005 and 2006, the debate about ethanol in D.C. has been poisoned by the confounded food versus fuel debate and other issues. The fact of the matter is there are industries that are well-funded and highly motivated to do damage to our industry's agenda. We are now taking a fair amount of the barrel out of the marketplace that big oil once had. So, you know, this ongoing debate over the past couple of years has been challenging. We've been getting out there with what we think are the facts, and we're pretty confident that we are supported in the fact that there is no challenge to food prices. Ethanol is not driving food prices. That's skyrocketing prices of oil. I don't want to preach to the choir. I know you all know that. But the fact of the matter is the challenge in Washington, D.C. right now is a pretty hostile environment. Our industry, I think, has stepped up and has indicated as early as last fall, hey, we recognize that the nation's budgetary problems are such that our industry has grown and matured to a point where the existing policies need to be reformed. We want to do so in a way that allows the industry to continue to grow and, more importantly, continue to evolve. But we recognize that change is in the offing. We stepped up. We said, we will work with you to eliminate the tax incentive. We want to make sure that we still have a growing market, meaning we need vehicles to put our fuel in beyond E10. We need to have a way to make sure that the infrastructure is compatible with those new fuels. We need more blender pumps. And importantly, the economics have to be right. Because while at $90 a barrel of oil that we have today, not an issue, at $50 a barrel of oil, $40 a barrel of oil, you know, you got to question what happens with the incremental demand and what that might mean for growing the market, seeing cellulose fully develop. So we want to make sure the economics are right. But ultimately, we need to, as Dr. Bruce Dale just said, we need to move this industry to continue to evolve. We need cellulosic ethanol to commercialize. We get these things, I think the future for the industry will continue to be bright, but that's going to be a challenge. The debate that's going on right now is, okay, how do we reshape ethanol policy in a way that allows that growth to continue, in a way that allows infrastructure to get the investments that it needs? And while there have been reports lately, as late as last night, that Senator Dianne Feinstein has a deal with Senator Thune and Senator Klobuchar to move this policy forward. I think deal is a relative term, and I'm not sure we are that close yet, but negotiations are, in fact, continuing. And you may see the tax incentive be phased out as early as August 1st. And in lieu of the existing tax incentive, they would fund some level of infrastructure, as yet to be completely defined, with tax incentives. They would allow the small producer tax incentive to be continued, at least for a time, and there will be some effort to assure that the cellulosic ethanol industry is also getting the incentives that it needs to continue to grow and attract investment. That's not the package that any one of us, I think, would want. But the reality is, in Washington, D.C., these days, you get what you can get when you can get it. And I think we're hopeful that there is a way to bring this to fruition. It's not a done deal by any stretch, because Washington remains a dysfunctional town. And finding a vehicle that will get to the president's desk is going to be the single most important challenge. There might be a deal. Everybody agrees to. Yeah, we'll sing kumbaya. Let's make it happen. But if there's not a bill that's going to get to President Obama's desk for his signature, it doesn't much matter. So that's the challenge. And Washington is as dysfunctional as it has ever been. I've worked in that town for more than 30 years. I've never seen the level of discourse as pitiful as it is right now. If any of you are familiar with the game rugby, that's what Washington is right now. It's just one big rugby game, and politics is you know, the rules or the sport. Over the past several weeks, the football that's been thrown into the scrum. And if you know what a scrum is, you get both sides, and they get down on their haunches, and they're shoulder to shoulder and cheek to cheek, and they're just pushing and pushing, and there's a ball in the middle, and people kicking around, and maybe it comes out left, maybe it comes out right, but it doesn't really matter because play will continue. That's what's going on in D.C. right now with our issue. A couple of weeks ago, we lost a vote on the floor of the Senate. I've never done that in the 30 years that I've been in D.C., 23 years working for this industry, we've never lost. And you have to, you know, what is it? Is it hemorrhaging support for ethanol? No, not entirely. The fact of the matter is, when those 73 members were voting on whether or not to eliminate the tax incentive immediately with no plan for the future, it wasn't about ethanol at the end of the day. It was largely about positioning folks on tax policy for future deficit reduction talks. The debate on the floor of the Senate, yeah, they were talking about ethanol, but behind the scenes, the undercurrent was, hey, wouldn't it be great if we were to get all these Republicans in support of tax incentives and eliminating tax subsidies as a means of deficit reduction? Because then they look like hypocrites when they continue to support the oil incentive. So at the end of the day, the actual merits of the ethanol tax incentive and ethanol policy generally, that was lost in the haze of the scrum that was going on. Does it mean that we are still, you know, have tons of support? No, it doesn't. But, you know, there were three votes that week. We won two of them. We lost one. And the politics of it were clearly having an impact on the debate. But within minutes of that loss, they defeated an amendment by Senator McCain that would have stripped the USDA's ability to fund infrastructure. So it wasn't a clean vote either way. We would be wrong to underinterpret the McCain vote, just as our opponents are wrong to overinterpret the vote on the Coburn Amendment. We need to recognize, however, that Washington is a different place, and it is going to be a challenging environment. I'm proud of our industry for stepping up and saying, we will put our policy on the table. Let's have a debate about what the future tax policy needs to be. I challenge, as I have before, any other industry to step up and say, you know what? Exxon doesn't need the taxpayer support to drill in the Gulf of Mexico at $100 a barrel either. There's no reason why big oil should continue to receive their subsidies. And I hope at the end of the day, there is a more comprehensive discussion about what our energy tax policy needs to be, and we're focusing on what do we want our energy future to be, how do we need to get there, and then we go about getting the policies that will result in the industry that we want. I prattled on longer than I meant to. I apologize, but I wanted to get those two issues off the table anyway. But let's just chat. Dr. Tumbleson?
Yeah. I want to comment that in 1991, at the first meeting, national meeting on corn to ethanol, Bob Dineen was the keynote speaker, and his thesis was, let's educate the public. And following up on that, let's talk just a minute about how we educate the public and how we find funds to have those pumps that will provide the necessary E85 or any other mixture into those vehicles that are already on the street.
Well, thank you. First of all, you made me feel old. Appreciate that. Educating the public isn't one association's job. It's not one company's job. It's all of our jobs, right? You all know more about ethanol in this debate than any editorial writer sitting around the table at the Wall Street Journal. Pick up your pen. Many of you do. Let them know how much they have abused the facts, ignored reality, and done a real disservice to their readers or viewers in perpetuating the myths about ethanol. We all need to correct the notion that it takes more energy to produce a gallon of ethanol than you get out of it. We need to dispel the notion that somehow we're driving the price of food while people ignore the skyrocketing price of oil and ignore the role of speculators in commodity markets. We need to be the responsible ones and constantly do that sort of thing. It will be a challenge for all of us. So I appreciate the comment. We need to do that. We need to show some outrage about the one-sided debate that's going on in Washington today. Somehow, ethanol has been the pinata. Farmers, you know, we don't need them, apparently. We just get our food from the Safeway. We need to make sure that we are educating people, that we're holding our members of Congress accountable, and we're letting them know what's important to us. And I think what's important to us is ending our addiction to oil. I think what's important to us is creating opportunities for rural economies. I think what's important to us is continuing to evolve this industry for new feedstocks and new technologies. And that will not happen if we just sit around our own breakfast tables venting frustration with what's going on in Washington. So, you know, I ask for your help because we certainly need it. Tom?
Yeah, Bob, since you're putting yourself on the spot this morning, I thought I'd kind of ask you to take us behind the curtain a little bit. I had a couple questions in mind.
With press in the room?
Yeah, sure.
Rachel, first, stop writing.
Kind of, tell us who in Congress is the biggest threat to our industry, the biggest thorn in your side? What members of Congress are our biggest threats? What members of Congress are our biggest allies? Just kind of refresh our memories on that. And I'd like to get your opinion on that, if you would. That might be a little touchy. Also, better question maybe, two-part question. When you're sitting at Rock Bottom Brewery with your members, you can only really speak to your members, but what are they telling you about VTEC and about the possible, you know, loss of the tariff? And, I mean, what are they telling you in private that you might be able to share with us, their fears or lack of fears? What are your members telling you? And that's, I guess, kind of a two-part question, kind of some buy-in.
I'll take the second part first, because okay. I think it's an important point. And I don't think it's necessarily something that we just have private conversations about. First of all, I'm too stupid to, you know, keep track of what I should say in public and what I should say, you know, in private, so I'm sort of an open book, right? I think there is confidence that because of the renewable fuel standard that provides the foundation for driving demand and growing and evolving the industry, that we can be just fine in the absence of the tax incentive. Now, there is an important caveat. We say that with the backdrop of $90 a barrel oil. And while it is hard to remember, because oil prices have been, you know, higher than 90, over $100, over $110 in the very near past, 25 months ago, we were looking at $39 a barrel oil. I mean, this is still a market that is subject to manipulation by our competitors. And there is a bit of angst about that, which is why the RFA was advocating for some kind of a variable incentive as an appropriate means of protecting the economics. Now, the reality is that in the political environment that we're working on right now, that kind of a debate isn't yet ripe. It might return if there is a more meaningful dialogue about energy tax policy, because I do believe that just as the ethanol industry doesn't necessarily need the taxpayer to be encouraging a gasoline marketer to blend ethanol in today's marketplace, neither should the taxpayer be expected to pay Exxon to drill in the Gulf at $100 a barrel oil. So I hope that we're able to have a more mature conversation about how to protect the investment that the taxpayer has made, not just in our industry, but in other energy industries as well. And I think a key to that is going to be variable incentives of all kind. But it's not on the table right now, and that's fine. We are looking at, I think, a situation where you're going to have higher-priced oil over the longer term. But, you know, what angers me, what frustrates me to no end, is the notion that somehow there's a free market in energy. The heck there is. Where's the free market when even this administration this week releases 30 million barrels from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, when there really isn't a supply shortage? So when our own government can manipulate the marketplace, I'm sorry, hello? What do you want your policy to be? But I think our industry, and not just my members, I think the industry is quite comfortable that because of the underlining policy of the renewable fuel standard and the reality of the marketplace today, we're 10% of the nation's motor gasoline. We're going to be okay. They can't just replace us. And what would they replace us with? More Canadian tar sands? Oh, that's a good idea. So I think we're going to be fine. I do hope that at some point there'll be some thought to how do we protect the economics to make sure that OPEC and our enemies can't manipulate this market in some way. In terms of our foes and opponents, look, it's not rocket science. Our strongest proponents are in the Midwest that have seen the rural economic benefits of a growing ethanol industry. They get it. Whether it's John Thune or Chuck Grassley or Tom Harkin or Amy Klobuchar or Dick Durbin or Kent Conrad or Tim Johnson, I mean, Senator Nelson, I mean, they're your members of Congress. They understand it. The folks that don't really get it, where are they from? Oklahoma, Texas, Louisiana. It's the oil states. I mean, that's who we're fighting all the time. So it's no real surprise that Tom Coburn from Oklahoma is, you know, most wanted, you know, in terms of our industry right now. I mean, he's the guy that's got us in the crosshairs. It is surprising, though, I'll tell you this, it's surprising that Senator Feinstein from California, who has probably more cellulosic ethanol companies in her state than anybody else, it's surprising that she is not being more constructive in these negotiations right now to try to assure that there's a better package for that evolving industry. I sort of scratched my head. Apparently, you know, she's more interested in making sure we can import ethanol from Brazil than she is developing markets in the Midwest or even in her own state. That one I can't explain away. Some of the others I can. It doesn't matter. The support for ethanol is always going to be there because of its rural economic benefits, because of the energy security benefits, and because we're the only option that is currently available to reduce greenhouse gases and do something to address climate change. So we're always going to have a pretty strong base of support. But don't be mistaken, we're always going to have well-funded, well-heeled, highly motivated opponents. Just makes for a better rugby game.
Thanks, Bob. And I wanted to say that we are running short on time, but we started a little late this morning. So whoever comes up to the mics here, maybe we've got, looks like we've got three guys here, and that'll be about it. So we'll get through these last three questions.
Mark?
Yeah. Bob, you mentioned Brazil, and that was one of the questions that I guess I had for you, is with all the policy changes being discussed in Washington, where do you see sort of the trade debate taking hold at? I mean, with respect to imports and exports in Brazil specifically, what does all of that mean with respect to the policies that we're going to see in the next few weeks?
Good question, Mark. Certainly, the secondary tariff that now exists is not likely to be maintained if you do not have a tax incentive available to marketers for ethanol use. Remember, the tariff wasn't there to protect the industry. The tariff was there to protect the taxpayer in the event that the product was coming in was already subsidized. There was just no reason for the U.S. taxpayer to subsidize already subsidized product. And so my expectation is that the tariff goes away at the end of this year. It might be good to maintain it to protect the growing cellulose industry, but I don't know where that plays out. I do expect that Brazilian product is going to come into the United States. We're not right now. As Rick Tolman mentioned yesterday, we're exporting to Brazil today. But I think you'll see more product from Brazil flowing here to take advantage of the higher advanced ethanol RINs. You know, there's going to be a market for that. That just might mean that there'll be more U.S. product going to Brazil. The absurdity of us bringing in 200 or 300 million gallons because our product can't be shipped to California to, you know, meet their standard, but we'll be having to ship 600 or 800 million gallons to Brazil to make up for their shortfall in production, which is likely to continue for a while. It does sort of boggle the mind, but I think that's what's likely going to happen. You will see increased exports. You'll also see increased imports. Rod?
Hi, Bob. Quick question related to flex fuel vehicles. You know, as the U.S. government wants to create jobs, improve the economy, what are your thoughts about Washington mandating auto manufacturers only produce flex fuel vehicles, which would give a serious competitive edge to the domestic three in Detroit, who have a large fleet of flex fuel vehicles?
Great question, Ryan. By the way, this is the guy that wrote the report on E15 that said there is no issue with higher level blends in some of these older vehicles. And I appreciate your work on that and the leadership that Ricardo has shown on fuel issues and automotive issues in the past. And indeed, you know, flex fuel vehicles are going to be a necessary reality if the market is going to grow. I mean, you can have market access. If you don't have a market, if you don't have the vehicles that are capable of using those higher blends, then it's not going to mean anything. So we absolutely need to have more E85 vehicles, or at least vehicles that are capable of running on something more than E10, which is what the auto manufacturers are saying today. Some of the autos have said, look, tell us what the number is. If it's E30, we'll make E30 vehicles. But tell us what the number is, give us a date, and we'll do it. The challenge for them appears to be trying to make vehicles that are truly flex fuel that can run over the wide spectrum and still meet the 216, 217 emission standards. I think that's bunk. I think they could most certainly do it, but that's the argument that they're making on Capitol Hill. There will be a debate about how to move forward on automotive technology and where to go. It's being teed up in many different ways. The administration talking about 56.2 miles per gallon certainly suggests that there's going to be a rather robust discussion about CAFE standards, and the opportunity to move something on flex fuel vehicles in that will exist. If there is an energy bill that ever begins to move, that would be an opportunity. I do see growing interest in an open fuel standard. Members of Congress that had never supported an open fuel standard in the past are now the co-sponsors of legislation in the House. John Shimkus of Illinois and Colin Peterson of Minnesota are two that in the past have not been willing to go there and are now supporting it. And that's certainly what we need in order to create the market that will allow for growth in this industry. Yeah.
Bob, it seems to me that we can't assume some things. There's a lot of smart people in the room, but we're on the right track. I mean, right makes might, and truth is on our side. But the story isn't always told. There's a lot of things it seems we can do, from the 400,000 people in the industry each telling their friends to talk to their congressmen or reps, writing letters to the editor. There's a whole lot of things, but I think a lot of us maybe don't know the best way to do it or how to bring up the right talking points. And it seems to me that the industries, and I know the RFA is fairly good at it, getting information out to its constituencies to say, here's things you can do, and this is the right thing to do. And since truth is on our side, it's an easy story. But I think we need some help, some primer on all the various things we can do, and it'll help us to be able to take some action.
Well, thank you for that. We do have talking points on our website, ethanolrfa.org. We also have a chooseethanol.org website that is more consumer-friendly. We're getting stuff out to folks all the time. But, you know, if you got a question about, you know, what I should be saying about the role of speculators, or you have a question about, you know, I'm getting pushback about this GAO report, certainly the RFA has just loads of technical data to be able to go back and you know, we've got great staff that is able to distill that and put it in a form that even I can understand. So, you know, certainly for a member of Congress, they could probably get it. But we do need all of you to be in that fight with us. And maybe that would be my closing thought. Look, if this industry is going to, no, I'm not going to say if, I'm sorry, when this industry continues to grow and evolve, we're going to have more vehicles capable of utilizing higher level blends. We are going to have infrastructure capable of moving those higher level blends to the market. We're going to have to make sure that the economics is right. And for the sake of the continued growth of this industry, we are going to have cellulosic ethanol commercialized. That's just the bottom line. So I would ask everyone in this room and the people that you work with and the friends that you know and, you know, the friends your kids know, everybody needs to be a part of this fight. I need you to make the magic happen again. You make it happen at the plants every single day. You need to help us make it happen in D.C. and awaken them to the growing threat that we face by the failure to meaningfully address our energy issues. Thank you very much.